American power centers, and variety and multiplicity of them makes it possible to initiate actions which some may appear random at the moment, but which indeed turns out to be of great significance. It's the very variety of initiatives, not dependent totally upon, let's say, a corporate structure only, or a government structure, or any other power elite group. There are all kinds of different interests.
Yeah.
And is that a point in your thinking anywhere?
It certainly became an issue in the turmoil of the 60s and the 70s. That turmoil saw the empowerment of many groups that previously had no power. We saw the student power through the Vietnam protests. We saw the peace movement generally. We saw the Black Power movement, and it was prior to that, America was a much more homogenized, centrally, not centrally controlled is too strong, but there was an elite that had a lot more control. And what we saw in the 60s was very much of an anti-elite set of movements, the hippies generating their interests. And sorting through all of this was an important aspect of research, and we certainly saw that through the criminal justice system, where there are many kinds of crime that are determined by power structure rather than by laws of nature, whereas theft and violence are reasonably universally seen as crime. A lot of economic activity, a lot of civic protest, a lot of political activity are certainly not given the freedom in most places that they are here, and that freedom really showed up in many ways in the 60s and 70s, a time of considerable turmoil in the country, a time when violence in the nation, violence rates, particularly rates of homicide by African Americans, really went very high, higher than they've ever been.
I'd like to continue with your thought of the change in Pittsburgh then. First of all, did you have some preconceptions before you came to Pittsburgh?
That's a very interesting question. I thought of Pittsburgh, having come from Washington, I thought of Pittsburgh as a very remote place, away from where everything interesting was going on. I thought of Pittsburgh as the Smoky City. This was 67, only about 10, 15 years, I'm sorry, 69, about 15 years from its transformation. And word hadn't quite reached Washington that it really was a nice place to live. And so I had some trepidation, but it sounded like an exciting job. And so I'd put up with whatever I had to take on that job, but never really expected to be here more than 2 years, for at least 15 years after I arrived. I would never bet more than even odds that I'd be here more than 2 years. It turned out that Pittsburgh was really a delightful place to be. My quick summary of Pittsburgh is that it's big enough to be a city, so that it has a lot of the amenities that you want in a city. It's small enough that they're very accessible, and there's enough corporate money around that it makes it far more attractive in terms of amenities than the market alone can sustain. We also found that it was a wonderful place to raise children. Our children were about 10-ish when we got here, and it was very convenient because all the fads took about 5 years to get here. And so we'd have early warning, and I was struck by how many of their friends from Washington got into trouble with drugs and the like. But there was a very much of a family town and a very comfortable place that we ended up having come to. We rented a house in Edgewood for the first year we were here. Someone told me about the wonderful school system in Edgewood. It turned out that our kids were the only Jewish kids in that school, which was somewhat of a surprise. And we were struck by they were using the Palmer method that I had used in the 30s to learn how to do penmanship. And they were very rigid when we took our children to when I was on spring break, we decided we'd go up to Mont Tremblant in Canada to go skiing, and took our children, of course, figuring that would be a great cultural experience. They'd be with people who speak French, and they'd get some sense of language. And the school was very hostile to the fact that we were taking them out. We told them we were taking them out, and that's when they gave us the hostile comments. So there was a primitiveness to life in Edgewood, and we did start looking around and ended up getting a house in Squirrel Hill, which is this delightful neighborhood.
It's on Whiteman Street. What number?
1455 Whiteman, on the corner of Northumberland Street. Mm-hmm. In this lovely house that we ended up buying about 30 years ago.
You were speaking of Richard King Mellon and the Renaissance that was going on in Pittsburgh, and also the problems. It was called Carnegie Institute of Technology before then, and you were starting to say about the fallout with the University of Pittsburgh.
Yeah, the Mellons had invested in a Chancellor Litchfield, who had been recruited. I think he had been dean of the business school at Cornell, and was recruited as the chancellor of the University of Pittsburgh, with some assurance that they wanted to build a world-class institution. And he took them seriously, I guess. And as I understand it, ended up spending lots of their money to try to build this world-class institution. And I think they had some second thoughts and ended up getting Litchfield fired as chancellor. And so there was this falling out with the University of Pittsburgh. My sense is that what was then Carnegie Institute of Technology, predominantly an engineering school with a very strong business school that was a major innovator in business school education, saw the opportunities of access to Mr. Mellon, merged with Mellon Institute, which was then a nonprofit private research institution, and together created Carnegie Mellon University. Since Andrew Carnegie's assets were totally depleted, that they felt that it would be a good idea to have Mellon in their name, where the Mellon assets were a major part of the wealth of Pittsburgh. And as far as I know, the major contribution until very recently was the $10 million endowment given to SUPA, the School of Urban and Public Affairs, to establish this new public policy school.
And the mission
The mission was primarily to find ways to manage public affairs better, and to train people to do that. The basic structure of the education program, it was a graduate school. It had a master's program that in many respects looks like an MBA program, because the students have to pick up the whole array of technical skills associated with management. But more in the way of political skills, more in the way of dealing with ambiguity, and more in the way of project courses. I think I was instrumental in urging the creation of project courses, and those have still are still an important part of the curriculum of the school.
Explain.
A project course is driven by a problem that students take on with a client, so it's the best approximation to a real-world consulting project. There's a client with a problem. The students study the problem, find out what they can do in the available time, and over the course of a semester or a year, and end up giving presentations of what they're going to do, with a mid-course presentation and then a final presentation with their best estimate of the solution of the problem. It's particularly useful because it gives students experience in formulating a problem. Usually the problem is formulated in a textbook. It gives students the experience of reaching conclusions where the data don't fully support the conclusion, but it's their best estimate. It takes them away from the answer in the back of the book. There's no definite answer, and it gets them into the mode of dealing with unstructured problems, which was a major thrust in the planning for the school. I got here in March of 69. We admitted our first students, I think, in September of 70. I was chairman of the curriculum committee and ended up in lots of rich discussions with Bill Cooper, who was the dean, and the other faculty members who were here. Most of the faculty were really spin-offs from the business school at Carnegie Mellon, and then there were a number of junior faculty that were brought in after that. So I think I was the first outside faculty member that came to the school.
About how many faculty were there at the beginning?
Probably about a dozen or so.
Mm-hmm.
And our first entering class of master's students had about a dozen students.
Mm-hmm.
We also had and have a PhD program that started off with a few students. We now have we admit about 7 or 8 a year, graduate about 4 or 5 a year, have a steady state of about 35 per year in residence at any given time. We've now built up to a master's program of about 120 or 130 entering each year from the initial dozen.
To finish on the thought of the projects, did you ever go back or follow some of the problems over the years?
Well, some of them. One of the more interesting projects we had was one that followed from a grant I got from the Urban Mass Transportation Administration. That's a time that this was in the early 70s when buses were being equipped with wheelchair lifts, and there was great attention to the needs of handicapped people. And my sense was that for the large majority of handicapped people, what they really wanted was point-to-point service rather than sitting in the snow waiting for a bus in their wheelchairs. And so I had this grant to design a brokered paratransit system. Paratransit being something above your own car but below the regular scheduled bus service. And the idea was to have taxi-type vehicles that with a broker organizing the taxi service to meet various people's needs. A whole bunch of social service agencies were providing their own buses for their clients, which struck me as pretty inefficient. So the idea here was to design the system that would have a broker working basically with taxi companies to take people from point to point to meet their needs. I hired a former graduate named Rick Stafford, who was working at Westinghouse at the time, and he was the project leader on it. We ran that project for 2 or 3 years, and that ended up becoming the access system, which I believe is still working today, under the authority of the Port Authority of Pittsburgh, Port Authority Transit, the bus company. When I initially invited them to be a member of the advisory committee for the project, they said, "What are you doing that for? We are in charge of all transit in the county." And there was an initially hostile response to it, until about a year later, that they decided they really would like to hire Rick Stafford to implement this full-time with the Port Authority. And that was the ideal outcome. So they did hire him, and they...